everyone. Lovely to have you all here. And really lovely to have, as a visitor to our court, the Honorable Rudolph Randa of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And look, our hair matches. Sorry. Okay, we're here to do serious business, they tell me. So, case number one. Wow. Okay, numbers 11-3519, 11-3627, 12-1016, 12-1290, United States versus Blitch. And good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors.
You're not Stephen Chobat. That's Stephen Chobat. You are?
Michael Weaver on behalf of Defendant Harris.
Nice to have you.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. If it may please the Court, Michael Weaver on behalf of Defendant Harris. This morning I will only address the District Court's denial of the entrapment defense of Defendant Harris and Defendant Carwell. My colleague, Mr. Chobat, will address the arguments related to sufficiency of the evidence in the jury instructions. This case presents the question of whether a defendant can present an entrapment defense to a jury when the following facts exist. One, the government uses a motivated informant to recruit the defendants. That motivation, his basis of cooperation was dependent upon him obtaining the defendant's cooperation in this scheme. Second, the informant and the government targeted individuals who had no history of armed robbery, stash house or otherwise, and for Mr. Harris had no history of distribution of drugs.
What kind of history did they have?
They had a criminal history of Mr. Harris had possession from 1999, and he also had a UWW, as well as a felony conviction.
Well, let's say they were not unfamiliar with the court system.
Correct, Your Honor. But they were unfamiliar with armed robberies, which is the...
Well, you have to start someplace, I suppose.
That is true, Your Honor. Number three, the defendant showed initial reluctance to this crime when they started. That's demonstrated by the confidential informant telling Mr. Gomez, the government agent here, that he had to work on Mr. Harris in order for Mr. Harris to show up to the third meeting held.
Was any effort made to procure the confidential informant to testify either at trial or before trial in support of the entrapment defense?
At the second trial, the first trial in 2007, Mr. Moore was unavailable for trial. That resulted in a reversal by this court on other grounds. For the second trial, when the court denied, the district court denied pretrial our right to an entrapment, we did not pursue Moore because his evidence would have gone to the entrapment defense. And as the district court denied that as a matter of law, we didn't pursue that further.
And assume that we agreed that the district court erred by barring your entrapment defense. What specific evidence or trial strategy would be different if Harrison Carwell had been permitted to put on their defenses?
The strategy would be fundamentally different in the sense of, for example, Mr. Harris, when we cross-examined Gomez, the main agent in this case, we focused on Mr. Harris's that he never agreed to the scheme, the government scheme. If the entrapment defense was available, we would have focused on what the government did to get Mr. Harris at that meeting on August 14th. So our cross-examining would be different, as well as the analysis of whether Mr. Harris should testify. Because as Your Honor indicated...
Was there any doubt that he was testifying in his own self-interest?
Mr. Harris or Mr. Carwell was the one who testified. Mr. Harris did not testify at trial.
Yeah, I'm talking about the informant you're talking about that lured your people into this terrible thing here.
Well, the informant, I think, based on his plea agreement, was focused on getting these individuals to participate. And that fact that the jury heard that fact but wasn't able to take that into consideration of what the government actions did.
You don't think they took that into consideration when they considered the whole case?
Legally, they weren't because there wasn't an entrapment defense.
No, I mean, there wasn't an entrapment defense because it was the judge didn't think there had been enough evidence to support one.
As a matter of law.
As a matter of law.
Which we respectfully disagree with.
Well, you're entitled to disagree.
Right. And the district court is entitled to disagree with us. Unfortunately, here is the district court focused on the criminal history of our defendants, which, again, did not have any background in armed robbery or stash house or otherwise. Mr. Harris's drug possession was only for drug possession distribution, and Mr. Carwell only had two minor distributions back from 97 and 2002, and that involved 9 grams. Here we're talking about 15,000 grams, and that goes directly to the inducement factor of the government. The district court's ruling by saying that criminal history predisposed the defendants and prohibited them as a matter of law from entrapment begs a policy issue of whether any criminal history automatically bars entrapment to a defendant, and that's not the law in this circuit.
What about the testimony? I don't know who it was. Was it Carwell that said, we've been waiting for this opportunity for many, many years?
Right. He did, but again, that's sort of idle chit-chat, and again, the jury should have determined when he's in the situation.
Sounds like a little more than idle chit-chat. I've been waiting for this chance to pounce.
Was it a chance to pounce the robbery? Because, again, remember, in this case, unlike other drugs...
I'm sure glad you came to tempt me, because I've been waiting to be tempted all this time.
Well, the temptation was either drugs or cash, because in this case, the government specifically said, but the charged crime is conspiracy to distribute, not obtain cash. And here, there was hundreds of thousands of dollars that the government said, not in drugs, but hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash. And that is very different than any other case that this panel has seen or this court has seen on the drug stash house cases, that Mr. Carwell specifically asked at exhibit on Government Exhibit 9, page 8, Carwell specifically says, is there going to be hundreds of thousands of cash? And Gomez specifically says, yes, I've seen that in there. I've seen it. I've seen stacks of money counters. And so for then the jury had a right to determine under entrapment of whether what the defendants were going for. And that goes to the statement of whether he's been waiting for hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash or distribute 15,000 grams of cocaine, when in the past he's only distributed 9 grams. And again, for Mr. Harris, he has no history of distribution. But again, the government targeted them for this crime.
I know that in the brief you maintained that he never discussed money or the distribution of drugs, but did he suggest any other plausible motivation for engaging in the crime other than profit?
Well, he never talked about money and drugs, as you're aware. But for the profit, that is one of the five factors that would have to be determined. So if the district court is deciding then if profit is the only motivation, then we don't have to look at the other four factors. But they didn't, again, look at the other four factors here. For example, the government's inducements, in addition to the cash, they also described the drug stash houses filled with maybe two or three people who were lazy and weren't expecting this type of robbery, again, minimizing the type of risk that the defendants may face going into the stash house. And why would they ask that? Why would the government present that picture? It's because they wanted to induce the defendants to do this crime. Mr. Gomez could have easily said, no, there's got 10 guys in there and they're heavily armed. Or he could have said, I have no idea what's in there, and let the defendants decide that. Instead, he enticed them and said, hey, there's only...
The temptation was too strong. I thought they could get away with it, is what you're saying.
That's entrapment, Your Honor.
Not always.
I mean, in the sense of if it overcame their reluctance to commit this crime.
Did they exhibit any real reluctance to commit the crime other than saying that they were looking forward to this?
Yes. Mr. Harris refused to meet. There was 4 meetings here. Mr. Harris refused to meet on July 27th and August 8th. And then on the day of August 15th when they were robbed, Mr. Harris specifically refused to go with Mr. Gomez's plan. He refused.
Mr. Clerk. Yes, Madam Clerk. What does the light mean?
So Mr. Harris specifically refused to follow Mr. Gomez's plan that he went to get into the van, the government van, as well as to get into the storage facility. So as I see my time is up, I thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Mr. Chauvet.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm going to be addressing the sufficiency argument as well as the jury instruction argument. Mr. Weaver made an important point, and that is With respect to what was in the stash house, all of the stash house cases that this court has previously decided have strongly emphasized that all that was present in the stash house were drugs. And therefore, anybody who would want to do an armed robbery...
I just had one fairly recently that I authored, which had money as well as...
Well, the opinion says... The opinion focuses on drugs being present. That was what was presented to the defendant.
The case involved a belief on the part of the participants that there was a lot of money there in addition to drugs. Lots of money.
Well, Your Honor, if you're referring to the Kindle case, the Kindle case is different than our case in other respects as well, such as the fact that there were significant post-arrest statements that indicated that the intent of the defendants was to go in and get the drugs and to sell them to others. None of that is present in this case. But all of the cases that talk about what was in the drug house focus on drugs and say, and from Corson, for example, the coke, not money, was the target of the robbery. Lewis again says that there was no evidence presented that he expected any money to be present. And the reason this is important is because a number of the defendants who agreed to participate in an armed robbery did just that. They agreed to participate in an armed robbery. There was no evidence from any statement. Let's start, for example, with Defendant Blitch. He made absolutely no statements about drugs, either acquiring them, their purity, their amount, to distribute them, nothing whatsoever. The only statement he made in the entire case was that if somebody drew a machine gun on him, how would he respond to it? And he said he would basically meet force with force. Mr. Harris, absolutely nothing about drugs. So nothing that they said indicated that their intent was to obtain drugs for the purpose of selling them.
So is it your argument that evidence that defendants agreed to steal a large quantity of drugs is itself insufficient to allow a jury to reasonably infer that their intention in stealing the drugs was to resell them?
Well, the assumption of your question is if the jury could conclude, based on statements that were made, based on prior history, based on actual drug dealing by the defendants, that their intention was to go into the drug house to steal large quantities of drugs, that might be sufficient in the appropriate case to warrant a finding for a jury to say, well, look, that was their intent. They had that intent, and they went out and got together to do a robbery. But in a case in which they are told and lured and led to believe that there are hundreds of thousands of dollars, and when there are repeated statements about trying to get money, and in which the defendants express no interest in the drugs. There's no interest. Are these pure drugs? Can we break them down four or five times? How will we distribute them? There's nothing. There's only one defendant who talked about actually distributing drugs, and that was a defendant, Carwell. And he did that when he was alone with the agent. And, of course, he can't conspire with the agent to sell drugs. He has to conspire with someone else. So all of the indicia that this court looks to decide whether there's action in concert, for example, there's no evidence that these defendants acted in concert. The CI recruited each one of them individually.
You see, you seem to be arguing that the reselling process needs to be a coordinated effort among co-conspirators.
Well,
do parties need to agree to sell the drugs together? Isn't it enough to rob the house together, then each take their share of the drugs with the understanding that eventually the drugs will be resold?
Well, there has to be coordination, Judge, with respect not necessarily to being out on the street selling the drugs. But if a single person simply sells drugs, that person's not guilty of a conspiracy. That person may be guilty of selling drugs, but not a conspiracy to sell drugs. And that's what they were charged with.
That they need to agree to sell the drugs together.
They need to collectively agree and have the intent, not that I will sell drugs with Mr. Washington or Mr. Harris will sell drugs with Mr. Carwell, but that they will sell drugs with someone. That in fact, that there is a joint agreement between one or more persons other than the government agent to sell drugs. Otherwise, Judge, it's distribution of narcotics. It's not a conspiracy to distribute narcotics. But more fundamentally, with respect to Harris, Washington, and Blitch, there was never any agreement in order to obtain drugs with the purpose that they would sell the drugs. And what the government wants this court to conclude...
Did the defendants present any evidence that they would do anything else with the drugs?
Well...
I mean, what they can do with...
Well, they, first
didn't
of all...
Did Carwell say we're going to flood the city with this?
Mr. Carwell talked about selling drugs when he was alone with the undercover agent. So, as I've indicated, if the government can point to that kind of statement with respect to Mr. Blitch, say, for example, or Mr. Harris, then I wouldn't be arguing that they didn't have the intent to sell drugs. But they've got to be able to point to something. You can't simply speculate that because they want to rob a facility that has lots of money, they may have gone in there and robbed it and not taken any drugs. They weren't interested in the drugs. What they were interested in were the money and the valuables. You know, that's why Radomski is an important case, because there was unquestionably no doubt that they were about talking about drugs and doing a drug transaction. And yet this court directed an acquittal, saying that, no, if the jury could reasonably believe that what he was really going to do was to steal money from the drug dealer and not engage in drug dealing. So it is not sufficient that someone engages in a robbery and the item there happens to be drugs, when there's other items there of greater value, and perhaps that is what the defendants were interested in. I know with respect to Mr. Washington, he said a number of times that's what he was interested in. And there isn't one whit of evidence that Mr. Harris or Mr. Blitch were interested in getting drugs as opposed to getting money or other valuables. That's what was presented to them, and that's what they intended to do. And, Judge, that is why it is so important that the judge had given the instruction that was proposed, that simply agreeing to commit a stash house robbery is not evidence of a drug conspiracy by itself. That's why we asked for that instruction, because we understand that ordinary people, lay jurors, would have difficulty accepting a premise that trying to obtain drugs is necessarily distribution of drugs.
Would Carwell have qualified for the instruction?
Would he have qualified for the instruction? He may not have, especially in light of he actually testified. But the others were certainly entitled to that instruction, and they had no intention. There was no evidence that they had any intention to sell drugs. You know, it's possible to steal a jewelry store and not take the jewels, but simply to take the money. And if a person didn't have experience in selling jewels on the black market, they might very well just leave the jewels there. Even though presented with an opportunity to rob a jewelry store, they agree to do so. There's no evidence that these defendants ever sold kilogram quantities of cocaine in their entire lives. There's no evidence that they knew how to do it or go about it or cut it or distribute it or were involved in that. So they were presented with an opportunity to get a lot of cash, and that's what they were interested in. And a reasonable jury should have been told, if that's what they were interested in, they're not guilty of this offense. So, one, we think that we're entitled to a direction of acquittal. But short of that, we certainly are entitled to a new trial where a jury could properly assess what their intent was. And we think as well, those two defendants that raised an entrapment defense, they could have their entrapment defense properly decided by the jury based on the inducement that they received and their reluctance that they expressed.
Thank you. Mr. Crickbaum?
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Crickbaum. I'm here on behalf of the United States. I'll start with the entrapment issue, where the district court correctly concluded that the defendants had not produced sufficient evidence of entrapment.
Right, because the district court concluded that the defendants were eager to participate in the crime. So what specific evidence was there that they were eager to participate?
I think, Judge Rovner, you can look at several different pieces of evidence. One is with respect to Defendant Harris, who not only participated in the crime himself, he actually recruited other people to become involved in the crime. Specifically, he brought Defendant Blitch into this crime. In addition, when the defendants got to the main meeting on August 14th, all of them, and certainly Harris and Carwell, were involved in enthusiastically planning how they were going to carry out this robbery. They initially started talking about whether they could simply rob the drugs off of Agent Gomez when he came out of the stash house. They decided that that wasn't going to be good enough, because if they just did that, they couldn't get all 15 kilograms which were in the stash house. So then they went on to plan how they were going to go in the house and get all the drugs. And specifically, Defendant Harris suggested that they were going to go in through windows in order to get those drugs. In addition, the government gave these defendants multiple opportunities to walk away from this crime. They never took those opportunities. And to the contrary, on August 15th, when the cooperating witness called these defendants and said, show up at this place at this time and be ready, all of these defendants showed up with loaded guns, ready to go, ready to commit this robbery. Now, Mr. Harris points to the cooperating witness's statement that he was going to have to work on getting Mr. Harris involved, and that's true. He did say that. I would say at the outset that none of these defendants ever produced any evidence from any witness who would say that the cooperating witness did anything improper during the course of this case. And the cooperating witness actually...
Well, you know, I must say, the cooperating witness's agreement to assist in convicting 10 individuals with Class X felonies, that's problematic. At the time it was entered, were there any potential crimes even being investigated, or were the 10 individuals at that time non-existent? Because what the government has done here is create an extreme incentive to create crimes for prosecution. And to be perfectly blunt, I worry about whether or not this is a common practice.
Well, Judge, I don't know the answer to your specific question, because this was a plea agreement that the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't enter into. It was entered into by the Kane County State's Attorney's Office. So I don't know whether any of these 10 were on the horizon when the agreement was entered into. What I can tell you is that in a post-trial hearing in this matter, the cooperating witness testified, and all of the defendants had a chance to question him, and the district court, Judge Bucklow, concluded that there was absolutely no evidence of the cooperating witness pressuring these defendants, threatening these defendants, or otherwise doing something improper. And that is why none of the defendants chose to call the cooperating witness as a witness at trial or to proffer any evidence that this cooperating witness would say in support of their defense. But in addition to the cooperating witness, Defendant Harris never proffered or presented any evidence from anyone who would say that he ever said no to this robbery, or that he ever refused, or that he was threatened or pressured. The cooperating witness could have potentially testified to that, but Defendant Harris could have said it if it occurred, or could have at least proffered to the district court that this evidence would exist. He proffered none of that. And so on the issue of reluctance, the district court's conclusion that these defendants were eager is amply supported by both their words on the recordings. For example, one of the times that the government gives these defendants an out and says, Agent Gomez says on August 14th, if you don't want to do this, tell me right now. I'll get another crew. A reluctant person at that point would have said, you know what, no thank you, and would have walked away. Defendant Harris was conspicuously silent at that point. Defendant Carwell spoke for all of these defendants when he said, you're effing with a bunch of wolves that's hungry. And then later, during that same meeting, as Your Honor pointed out, he said, we've all been waiting on this for I don't know how many years. And I think that sums up what this case is about. The defendants were waiting for this opportunity. The government presented them with the opportunity, and they embraced it enthusiastically. And that is not entrapment. As for the other factors this court considers, for example, the defendants' reputations and characters, neither Harris nor Carwell proffered or presented any evidence about their character or reputation that would rebut their predisposition. And there was substantial evidence that showed that they were predisposed. For example, when Agent Gomez asks these defendants point blank on August 14th, have you done this before? And Defendant Harris twice says, we're certified. That was a yes. In addition, if you look at Mr. Harris's convictions, it's true that Harris doesn't have any drug trafficking convictions. Carwell does. But Harris had three convictions for aggravated battery, the last of which he was on parole for. He had been out for about a month before he committed this crime. That was a conviction for what he was convicted for, along with some other inmates, beating a fellow inmate, kidnapping him, and forcing him to drink his own urine. He also had a prior conviction for aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. And both of those groups of convictions are relevant to the issue of whether he's willing to use a gun to violate the law and whether he's willing to commit violence. And Defendant Carwell had a conviction for a drug trafficking crime. It involved a much smaller amount of drugs, it's true, but it was perfectly consistent with what Carwell said he was going to do in this case, which was to break the drugs down and sell them off in $10 and $20 bags.
Let's see if we can go this way. The government's brief on appeal confuses the issue of allowing an entrapment defense and providing an entrapment jury instruction. In light of that distinction, how can we be absolutely certain that the defendants weren't prejudiced if we conclude the district court did err in precluding Carswell and Harris from at least putting on their defense?
Well, Judge, I don't agree that we confused the issue. The fact is that all...
You did.
Fair enough, Judge. All of the evidence that the defendants proffered pre-trial in support of their entrapment defense was admitted at trial. All of it was. It was all admitted in the government's case in chief. The district court ruled that it was relevant to the defendant's intent. So everything they said they were going to put on, they put on. After that evidence was admitted, none of the defendants asked the district court to reconsider its pretrial ruling. None of them asked for a jury instruction. And I think the legal question is the same, which is, does the evidence that the defendants either proffered or that they actually presented at trial, if taken as true, is it sufficient for a reasonable jury to find that they were entrapped? I think that's the legal question, and the district court applied that standard and correctly said that the evidence was insufficient.
Well, what additional evidence are you suggesting that the defendants should have presented to support their entrapment defense?
Well, I think when you look at the factors that this court considers, the only factor that supports the defendants in this case is whether it was the government who approached the defendants to commit this crime, which, of course, is very common. It happens in every sting operation. So, for example, showing that they were truly reluctant rather than, in fact, eager. This court has rejected entrapment defenses even in cases where defendants testify or proffer that they said no multiple times to a cooperating witness or to a government agent, and the agent keeps persisting. That would be an example of something they could have presented, but they never did. Another example would be, let me talk about the nature of the government's inducement, because I actually think that's an important factor here. There's no question that these defendants were expecting a big payoff from this crime. But I also think it's important to remember what they were willing to do in order to commit it. And that's something that this court emphasized in the Kindle case just last month. They were willing to invade a stash house that was run by a Mexican drug cartel. They knew that it was guarded by men with guns because Agent Gomez told them that. They were willing to kill those men if they needed to. They talked about that. They were willing to risk being killed themselves, also that they could steal 15 kilograms of cocaine and sell it and flood the city with it. Now, that's the type of opportunity that a law-abiding citizen would not embrace. The type of person who embraces that opportunity is the type of person who's predisposed to commit serious crimes.
Was the cooperating witness available at the time of the second trial?
Yes. He was served with a subpoena in open court. And he was available, and the defendants, all of them, said clearly on the record that they did not intend to call him. If there are are no other questions about the entrapment issue, I'll turn to the sufficiency of the evidence. The jury was entitled to conclude that at least one of the objects of this conspiracy was to steal 15 kilograms of cocaine so the defendants could divide it and sell it. Now, Mr. Shobat said, and he said it several times, that the defendants had no interest in these drugs.
Yeah, so what evidence is there that would provide evidence of an understanding between all of the defendants to resell the drugs from this fictional stash?
Well, first, all of the defendants were present on multiple occasions when Agent Gomez told them there are at least 15 kilograms of cocaine in this stash house. They were also all present at the August 14th meeting when they talked about how in order to get all 15 of those kilograms, they were going to have to go in the stash house. They couldn't just rob Agent Gomez as he came out of the stash house. They had to go inside. And it was very clear they were talking about they needed to do that so they could get all of it. It's in Government Exhibit 9, pages 22 through 27. Also on August 14th, all of the defendants were again present when Defendant Carwell said that after the defendants stole this cocaine, they were going to need to repackage it. Now, the only reason that they need to repackage it is because, A, they've stolen it, and, B, they're dividing it so they can sell it. And finally, the next day, August 15th, all of the defendants, again, are present when Agent Gomez says, follow me, I'm going to take you to the storage facility where the cooperating witness is going to leave my share of the cocaine. The understanding of all of these defendants was that they were stealing that cocaine, and they were going to divide it and sell it. Mr. Shobat's client, Mr. Defendant Washington, made that crystal clear at his very first meeting with Agent Gomez. At that very first meeting, Defendant Washington is already talking about having 3 kilograms of cocaine after this robbery, after the defendants steal it and split it evenly. The defense argument here is that maybe the defendants wanted to rob a drug stash house, but they weren't actually interested in any drugs, which is an implausible argument, but it is also one the defendants made at length to the jury during closing arguments in this case, and the jury rejected it, and they were entitled to reject it, because even if the defendants were interested in getting money, and it's possible that they were, but there is also ample evidence and certainly sufficient evidence for the jury to have concluded that they were interested in getting drugs, which is why they talked about it so much. In fact, that's the main reason that these defendants were willing to rob the stash house and risk their lives, because they knew that there was going to be a big payoff. And that big payoff was their share of 15 kilograms of cocaine. On the issue of the jury instruction, the district court did not abuse its discretion in refusing to give this instruction. The instructions that were given were correct. There's no dispute that they were accurate. They correctly defined all of the elements of the conspiracy. At that point, I think this court can stop, because the court has said many times that if the instructions accurately define what the crime is, it's not necessary to list out all of the different ways that it's possible not to commit the crime, which is what the defendants were asking for here. But in addition to that, the instruction was also wrong. It was incorrect as a matter of law, because once this jury concluded that the defendants were going to rob or steal 15 kilograms from a drug stash house, the jury was perfectly entitled to conclude that the agreement was to possess that cocaine with the intent to distribute it. That is a very reasonable inference. It's one the jury was correct in making and entitled to make. And so the defendant's instruction, which suggests otherwise, which suggests there has to be something more, is incorrect, in addition to being unnecessary. If there are no other questions, I'll ask the court to affirm the defendant's convictions and sentences.
Thank you very much. Yes. Mr. Weaver.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, I think the government's argument points to our exact argument that this is a jury question. The government raised a number of issues that should have been decided by the jury as opposed to the district court pretrial as a matter of law, and that's exactly what happened here. That's how our prejudice hits, is because we were never entitled to present that evidence at trial in the sense of the government cut that out of us before. So that's why it should have been allowed to be at least presented to the jury. In addition to the arguments of the walking away, this court has already rejected that reluctance requires a defendant to walk away. And also in the sort of the eagerness issue, as this court has said, it's irrelevant that entrapment was so effective to make him not only a willing but eager participant. So again, it's the question of what happened before, what Mr. Moore did, what the government inducements did to come over the reluctance of the defendants. And here, that reluctance, that incentive was the cash in the house, the reduced risk of going into the drug stash house. And if there's no other questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver. Mr. Schiffer.
I'll just make two observations. The first is that the last comment that the prosecutor made is that the jury was perfectly permissible to draw the inference because that they wanted to get the drugs because that's why they talked about it so much. But in fact, they did not talk about it at all. Christopher Blitch said nothing, not one word about drugs throughout the entire episode. Mr. Harris did not talk about drugs. It's true that Mr. Carwell did, and it's true that Mr. Washington made a statement, but they did not talk about it. The agent talked about drugs, not the defendants. And the last thing is the argument that, well, we argued this to the jury, and therefore, well, we lost, we struck out, really rings hollow when the jury was not given an instruction that would have given them a legal basis on which to accept our arguments. We had to make our arguments without an instruction. Had they been properly instructed, they may have been very well receptive to our argument, as they were to the attempt charge, which they did acquit us of. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Shobat. Now, you all were court appointed, weren't you? You have the deep thanks of the court for taking on this responsibility, and not just taking it on, doing it with so much fervor and talent. So thank you very much. And as always, we're very happy that there is a government and that you come here. All right. Case